Thanks, Eric. Okay, this is a far cry from a 100-student basic soils lecture, but I appreciate the intimate setting. I want to talk about some work we've been doing to constrain rates of cryoturbation in permafrost-affected soils. So this is some work that I've done with Kyung-Soo Yu, who's in my department here at the University of Minnesota, and Jonathan Kleminder, who's at Umeå University in Sweden. Just a little bit of context. Cryoturbation is really important for northern circumpolar carbon stocks. Current estimates place about 35% of the soil organic carbon to 3 meters in the northern circumpolar region in cryoturbated soils. So understanding these physical mechanisms is also just as important as understanding the biochemical mechanisms when we think about the carbon response to climate change. I want to talk specifically about a mechanism of cryoturbation that occurs in these features called non-sorted circles. We focused on these. There are other mechanisms of cryoturbation, but these are really ubiquitous patterns that are found on the ground in a lot of Arctic regions. Some of you that may have been up to some Arctic regions have seen these. They're active features. They're spatially repeating. They're regularly spaced, usually on the ground, and they exhibit really well-defined morphology. So it makes it an easy place to start when we try to constrain the rates of cryoturbation in these soils. And on a couple of these slides, I'll use this terminology, inner domain and outer domain. So the inner domain here just means this circle. It's a little bit hard to see in the photograph, but these are non-vegetated circles. And they're surrounded by vegetated areas that have thick organic horizons. And so the inner domain is this non-vegetated area in the circle. The outer domain is this well-vegetated area outside of it. If we took a transect through this and excavated a soil pit, we'd need a jackhammer. And a few other tools that we're not used to using, but it would look something like this. So here's a cross-section. The inner domain, this is our usually non- or sparsely vegetated area, mineral soil all the way up to the surface. Don't know what happened there. And the outer domain has a thick organic mat. The permafrost table is usually bowl-shaped, so it's lower underneath the center, and we usually see organic-rich materials right along that permafrost table. I'll explain why in a second. So the way that these things are maintained and formed basically has to do with differences in thermal conductivity. So mineral soil conducts heat about an order of magnitude faster than organics, mostly because of the pore space and some other physical properties. So what that means is that in the growing season, as these things are thawing, they're going to thaw faster and deeper where we have the mineral soil exposed in the center. And so that's why the permafrost table is lowest underneath the center there. And then accordingly, on the edges where we have a thick insulating organic mat, the permafrost table is much higher. And so we get this bowl shape. What that does is also it means in the winter, the freezing front penetrates faster. So the place where ice starts forming first in the winter is in the center as well. And if we all dig back to basic soil physics, water migrates to the freezing front. So we get the formation of ice lenses in the center, which causes this heave. So usually these things have a little bit higher center. As this heaves, it pushes material outwards, and so we have this centrifugal movement of soil outwards. And then a subduction of what was surface material down towards the permafrost table. And this is a really important process for thinking about carbon effects, because we're basically taking this carbon and putting it in the freezer. So if we can kind of generalize this, it's this pseudo-circular motion, mirror images, if we could imagine, on each side. So the major questions are the surface and subsurface rates similar of movement here? Is the subduction of this organic material, is it continuous? Does it happen in a regular kind of time steps? Or is it stochastic? Are there climate triggers? And that's something that's really important to understand when we think about feedbacks. And is there a climate sensitivity to this whole thing? So in other words, we think about biochemical climate sensitivities of Arctic carbon. What about the sensitivity of physical mechanisms? So we use a tracer suite, a whole bunch of different elements, carbon, mercury, lead, to name a few, stable carbon isotopes, radioisotopes, 137 cesium, lead-210, beryllium-10, and carbon-14. Most of you may be familiar with carbon-14 and some of these other ones. The other radioisotopes differ in their half-lives and their mechanisms of formation. So lead-210 is geogenic. It's caused by the decay of uranium-238 in the soil. It has a half-life of a couple decades. Cesium-137 is from atmospheric weapons testing primarily, and that has a half-life of about 30 years. And beryllium-10 is cosmogenic. It's caused by high-energy solar radiation. hitting oxygen atoms in the atmosphere, and that has a half-life of 1.5 million years. These are all atmospherically deposited as fallout, but they all have widely different half-lives. And so using all these things in concert, we can start to understand the rates and patterns of cryoturbation. I don't want to go through the models that we use, but we used different models for these isotopes. So we used 137 cesium and lead-210 to derive surficial rates of movement, carbon-14 and beryllium-10 to look at subsurface movement and residence times. So our study site was in Abisko, courtesy of Jonathan Kleminder at Umeå University. This site's above the Arctic Circle. That yellow line there is the Arctic Circle in Abisko, Sweden. And we looked across this kind of radial transect on a non-sorted circle. You can see at the top square there is the center of the circle, and then moving outwards towards the inner, and then a mixing transition where the inner and outer domains meet, where presumably the organic material is being subducted, and then two spots in the outer domain. And we took 3-inch cores here. We were doing this on a shoestring budget, so we had to do what we had to do. One thing we noticed with the morphologies is that the organic horizon thickness increases outward, so there's no organic horizon in the center. Much thicker organic horizon in the outer domain, that's what we normally see. pH decreases outward, so the lowest pH is in the outer domain where we have thick organic materials and organic acids. And then as we're in the center, we have mostly mineral soil, so the pHs tend to be higher. And we did note in just the morphological characteristics of these cores two potential parcels of cryoturbated material in the center and the inner domain. So again, we're looking from the center on the left out towards the outer domain. Here's an example of some of the depth distributions of these tracers. So this is 137 cesium and lead-210 from the center again on the left towards the outer domain. And what you can see is that there's very little of these tracers in the center. That speaks to the non-surficial origin of the material that's at the center. It's coming up from below. And these are decadal scale tracers, so this has happened very recently. And then you can see that they accumulate going outwards. So this material is moving outwards, and it's accumulating these tracers as it goes out. The really interesting thing we found is that beryllium-10 has widely different depth distributions. And remember, beryllium-10 has a half-life of 1.5 million years, so it's recording different histories than 137 and lead-210. One thing that you'll note on the left side is those spikes, those subsurface spikes, and those actually correspond with the cryoturbated parcels that we identified. So that tells us that those cryoturbated parcels were at the surface for a significant amount of time to collect that much beryllium-10 before they were subducted and are now in the subsurface. And then you can see on the far right in the outer domain, the beryllium-10 profile looks like it's increasing with depth. This is the area that's most acidic. And so we think that there's some leaching over time. It's a very stable surface, acidic, and there's leaching over time of beryllium-10. Just to show you some examples of how these tracers are associated, this is a normalized, the x-axis here is just a normalized amount of each of these tracers, so it's not an absolute amount from 0 to 1 in these profiles, and then depth on the y-axis. So if you look on the far right with the beryllium-10 tracer, you see that spike, that subsurface spike, and that's a cryoturbated parcel that's in the subsurface. And what you'll note is that spike is convergent with spikes in carbon, mercury, which is also atmospherically deposited, and some changes in the delta 13C. When we carbon dated that just bulk radiocarbon age for the organic carbon in that sample, it came out to about 1900 years before present. And then in the outer domain, we don't see those peaks. So those peaks are not convergent. The beryllium-10 profile on the right looks leached. Again, it's increasing. And we see these continuously decreasing distributions with depth. We don't see those convergent spikes like we saw in the inner domain. So when we combine all this information together with our models, what we find is that these rates on the surface, and this is from the first rate there, 1.4 centimeters per year, that's from the center to that first part of the inner domain, and then from the inner domain to the mixing transition, we see that these are on the order of about centimeters per year. When we look at the subsurface, these rates are about on the order of millimeters per year. So it seems like the material in the subsurface is moving about an order of magnitude slower than on the surface. When we look at the beryllium-10 concentrations of these cryoturbated parcels, what we find is that the previous surface residence times of these parcels was on the order of centuries to millennia. So this has huge implications potentially if this pans out in other non-sorted circles, because it means that there's a stochastic mechanism for how these parcels are being subducted into the subsurface, and therefore we need to understand the climatic triggers that cause this to happen if we're going to predict the fate of the carbon in these systems. So conclusions, again, rates of superficial movement are about an order of magnitude greater than rates of subsurface movement, centimeters per year versus millimeters per year. Meteoric beryllium 10 suggests century to millennial scale surface residence times, which suggests stochastic processes for subduction. And the other thing that we found is that physical forces may play a huge role in homogenizing and dispersing the organic carbon to almost make it unrecognizable by the time it comes back in the material center. So we may not be able to morphologically identify it. Ongoing work, we're now doing full gridded sampling of these features. So this is a 10 by 10 centimeter grid laid out over a transect on this non-sorted circle. We're doing these along climatic gradients, so latitudinally along the Dalton Highway in Arctic Alaska. We're going to add some other tracers. And in this work, I'd also like to acknowledge Purdue University's Prime Lab for giving us a seed grant to do the Beryllium 10 work on this, and the National Science Foundation Graduate Research Fellowship, which helps support some of the personnel time. So thanks, and I'll take any questions if we have time.
Yep, almost a perfectly timed talk, 12 minutes. There's time for questions.
You not get any. Yes, sir.
Can you tell us a little bit about the Beryllium 10? How far do those cosmic rays penetrate into the soil material? Certainly, it's not just a surface reaction. And does that complicate your interpretation at all, seeing that spike, that subsurface spike?
So there's two flavors of beryllium 10. There's beryllium 10 that's formed in mineral matrices when cosmic rays actually penetrate minerals, right? And they create a beryllium 10 atom in the crystal structure of the mineral. Then there's meteoric beryllium 10, which is created in the upper stratosphere when cosmic rays strike oxygen, and that falls out to the surface. So what we were looking at here is meteoric beryllium 10, not the in situ kind, which is in the mineral matrices. And so we were looking at beryllium 10 that only fell out to the Earth's surface.
Could you just follow, how do you extract that differentially from the beryllium 10?
So the meteoric beryllium 10 is about 100 to 1,000 times more abundant than in situ, and the mineral crystal structure beryllium 10. And so to extract the crystal structure beryllium 10, you actually have to physically dissolve the minerals. To look at meteoric beryllium 10, you just take off the adsorbed portion. And so we're not actually dissolving the minerals. So that's how we would separate them.
Any other questions?
Lee? I'm just curious, Nick, you know, your discussion, I was interested in, but do these circles migrate at all?
There's evidence that they do. Okay. And that's another open question. We don't know how quickly. And so that could have huge effects. In fact, Chen Lu Ping, we were just up in Alaska this summer, and he was talking about a site where, you know, these circles have migrated, and so you basically have this huge amount of carbon in the subsurface because over time, it's not necessarily related to the circles, but over time it's been crowdsurbated downwards. But that's an open question. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Great.